thanks for coming. And since we are now here in this garden, and maybe not everyone knows about the garden, but you can just explain a little bit how this garden is structured.
Yeah, this garden here is not a permanent garden. It's like a mobile garden. We started at this place in 2009, and it was like a before World War II, there was a big warehouse on this place, and after that, it was that has been totally destructed during World War II. And since that, this there has not been any building on this lot. And Robert and Marco have founded this garden. Robert has been in Cuba before that, and in Cuba they started to have this kind of mobile gardens in the cities after the Soviet time and before the Chavez time, because they didn't have enough fuel to get the agricultural products into the city. And Robert saw that there, and the Cuban military moved some containers with soil into the cities, and people in the community started to grow their food there. Our perspective is not to feed the community around here, but basically more the social and pedagogical aspect of the thing. So up to now, about 75% of all vegetable breeds have died out in the last 100 years, and we try to keep some of the old species, and especially show them to people, because most people only know the salad they know from the supermarket, and we try to grow old species. This garden is a participative project, so everybody can come around and join us and garden with us together. And we definitely don't want to be this like a Schrebergarten. We don't want to have everybody having his own little bed and growing his stuff there, but we want to work together with all the people. And as I said, everybody is invited to come around. And it is organized by a so-called GmbH, the Limited of Public Benefit, something like that. And so we don't get a funding by the city, something like that. We have to rent the place by ourselves. So in a way, it's like a public. We're doing what the public should do, what the government should do, to inform people about old vegetable species and to bring people, especially in this relatively socially problematic neighborhood. And yeah, as I said, everybody can come around and help us. And we also have lots of children here, and our main thing is this pedagogical and social approach, just to bring people together by gardening, and to show people what different plants actually exist that they don't know of.
And so many people ask me all the time get part of the harvest.
The harvest, most of the harvest, we try to cook ourselves in the kitchen for the bar. And the other stuff, it depends. People who are helping here get the stuff really cheap. They can harvest themselves in the beds. They have to ask the person that is responsible for that on that day. And people who work here can get the vegetables really cheap. The people who just come here consuming, sitting in the bar, and basically it's not that we have anything against it, but they we need some money to keep the space, and so the people that just come to consume have to pay a relatively high price for the vegetables. But the soil that we use is all bio-certified soil, and we don't use any mineral fertilizer, neither pesticides. So it is all organic food, and many people are willing to pay a higher price just to support us.
Mm. Are there other?
I'm just really curious. Why doesn't the government support you and give you money? I mean, it's a classic thing that they should be giving funding. Do they have a reason? Or
actually, we don't want this because we have a totally different way of arguing if we pay it ourselves. We are not beggars who are depending on the government, but we do it ourselves.
I'm not saying beggars, but I mean it's a pedagogical thing that you're doing with education, and the government's purpose is a huge part of it is education.
Of course.
And also the social aspects, so they should be interested in...
Definitely they should be, but and we get some... Since we have a big press echo, maybe it would be possible to get some public funding, but then we are depending on the government or on the whatever who gives us this funding, and we don't want that.
Well, they could do their own initiatives, maybe. I mean, maybe that's another strategy then. That
as long as we are able to pay for the rent, and most people who are working here are working without getting paid. The people at the bar get paid. And everybody who is working here, or basically everybody who is working here full time, gets paid. Not well paid, definitely not, but somehow paid. And so our money basically comes from the bar and from some vegetable sale. But of course, we sometimes get some funding, but it's not a regelmäßig.
Yeah,
it's not regular, but sometimes. The lease we have on this place is always for 1 year, and we definitely have to move someday. The government already tried several times to sell this place, and definitely there's going to be something built somehow. We don't know when, but of course it's a interesting lot for investors, and earlier or later definitely someone is going to buy it, and then we have to move. But that is actually our plan, and then therefore we grow all the stuff in containers so that we can that we are not dependent on soil, but can also use it like a parking space or a flat roof or whatever.
It would be really good to get to the stage where you can force the government to include you or some similar project and the design of
this
in their building.
Maybe we continue this like more. No, it's okay. But maybe we continue the larger discussion in the end because there are so many questions on it. But anyway, is it okay?
Because
I'm
so sorry.
Because what you see here now is a potato garden in the. In the garden, since some years I've been really interested in the potato plant. Dorothy gave a very nice introduction, but I also just want to add that I think it's interesting. It's a cultivated global migrant plant, and it originates in the Andes in South America, but it's today spread all over the world. And it's grown on all continents. So it's a very adaptable plant, both to different farming conditions and also to different food cultures. In India, it's understood as a very typical part of Indian food culture, and in Germany, it's a very German part of food culture. So it's really adapted to cultures in different places. And because of this, it has become politicized in a way I find really interesting. It can be a remedy for the global fast food cooperative production, as well as it can be the poor small-scale farmers' most important staple. Can you hear me all? Is it okay? Yeah? Good. And last year, I was asked to contribute to the garden with my work, and then I suggested that we grow some varieties from which I've made this narrative, the order of potatoes. And on these bags circulating here, you can see, I think it was something like 15 different varieties. And more or less all of these varieties are not allowed to grow for commercial circulation within EU. And the reason for this is that they either have features that don't make them pass the so-called DUS test to enter the European variety list. And the DUS stands for durability, uniformity, and stability. And these are qualities made up to meet the needs for industrial farming. And to be able to enter the national variety list or the EU list that allows the variety for commercial circulation, you have to live up to these standards. So this is for not for all plants. I think it's not for apples, actually. I think there is at the moment a big discussion if apples should be included in this kind of test system or not. But potatoes are. So this could be one reason that they are not allowed to be listed, and another reason could be that there is not enough commercial interest in them, because to be listed is quite expensive. It costs maybe 20,000 euro just to go through the test for the variety, and then you have to pay every year maybe something like 700 euro to keep the variety on the list. So if it is a variety that is not like a big commercial seller, it's a big risk for a farmer, for example, to invest in this. So the varieties we grow here, they are more or less older farmer-bred varieties. And they were bred in a time when farming took place during very different conditions compared to today, or compared to industrial farming. And what I do in this project is that I connect each variety to a story that gives an idea of its historical political context, and all together these stories make a larger narrative on how potatoes got disciplined and organized in a way that today makes it illegal to grow them commercially. So you can look at them around, and there are also in the potato field some of these same information signs. Yeah, and a lot of this work is done in the garden by Bernard Marcus, who is a gardener also. So maybe it's interesting to hear a little bit on your approach, because you are somehow now also growing. Most of what you see here is what you have initiated this year.
Yeah, I come to the garden in September 2009, and I am studying my bachelor in agriculture and my master in plant sciences. And Roman, one of the garden of the initiator of the garden, asked me to during the winter if I want to make the project, the potato project. And the potatoes are a culture from my from my job, from my studying, and then I say yeah, I wanted because I love it to work practically and write about the practical work. And so I built last year and this year the potatoes in the garden in the deck the young growing veggie potatoes. When the potatoes growing up to 13 centimeters, we put in more soil in the rock and rolling the rock up, and this make we 3 times, and in every lane we are building new potatoes, and by the end of the year we have a jar full of potatoes. We built 16 varieties and they are from the 1600 until today.
And you organize also workshops when there are like larger, more labor intense work. Like for example, the whole planting was a workshop that you organized, and the harvest will in the same. Oh shit! That was my water. The harvest will also be a workshop.
And also a workshop for the joy or maybe you and Matthew for the breeding of the potatoes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how, when you are finished, how high is the sack? It's like this now, and you fill it 3 times, and will it be like that?
About from the...
In the middle. Okay. Will it tip over? You have to stabilize it, or it will stand on its own?
Sometimes they are kind of difficult, but normally it works. You can just give them a kick and then they will stand.
But they are stability by 3 times putting the soil, and by one more time they are not so stability.
So this year you're growing 16 or nearly 18 actually.
Yeah.
18 different varieties.
Yeah. 19
even, yeah. So it's
and
getting more.
Last year we built 15.
All illegally?
It is not illegal to grow them, it's just illegal to sell them as food.
It's actually a gray zone because I think in Germany there is a paragraph that you can sell in small quantities only as food, and that's allowed. But it's this kind of more industrial, larger circulation that is not allowed. So it means that you cannot get them in the supermarket, but you can get them on a smaller farmer's market or something like that.
Yeah, I remember the Bamberger Mansion.
Yeah.
They are erecting.
Yeah.
You can sell every potato as a plant potato. That's not illegal. You can sell if you tell people that's not food, but just a tuber for an ornamental plant for your garden, then it's not illegal to sell them and to grow them. It's just illegal, and it's not illegal for the people to eat them, of course. It's just illegal to sell them as food.
So not chips.
Sculpture is better. Yeah, so I also got really interested in all these different qualities of these varieties. They have very different features, and they are suitable, for example, for specific microclimate conditions, like very dry conditions or long nights in the north of Scandinavia, and some have different... like blue colors or red colors or very strong yellow colors, and these are like antioxidant qualities of the potato. So there are in many ways different qualities. And also there is so we got interested in breeding, and we started to talk about breeding our own varieties. And also that it could be really interesting to learn more about breeding potatoes ourselves. So, maybe you should tell a little bit about potato breeding.
So, from the gardener's view, breeding potatoes is very interesting because it's that easy. Normally, most of vegetable plants you grow from seeds, and therefore you have different generations. Potatoes are normally cloned because if you replant a tuber that you've got from last year, it is genetically identical. If you want to breed a new potato, a new tomato species, for example, you have to breed, inbreed it for at least 7 to 10 generations, at least, to get a new stable variety. Potatoes are normally always cloned, so you just have to have one mutation or one very special recombination of the genes, and then you have a new breed, because you, from that point on, you will only grow the potatoes from tubers and not by pollination and from seeds. And therefore it is very easy if we have seeded about 150 potatoes from last year. And we do not know what the father plants are. Of course, we know the mother plant because we took the fruits from the mother plant, but we don't know the father plants. But even if you have one variety and inbreed that and use the seeds from that, you get a totally different variety because they are not stable, because they are normally cloned. And therefore, for us, it's very easy. We had we seeded about 150 potatoes, and we will keep maybe about, we will give them pretty bad conditions in the beginning and let some of them die off so that we can have the most resistant plants. And from the 150 we seeded, we will try out in sacks maybe about 20 to 50, something between that. And maybe even in this autumn there will be a new variety from the Prinzessin garden. We don't know what the outcome will be of this potatoes because we don't know what the father plant is. And even if we'd know, we could not tell exactly what the outcome is. And so it's very easy because you just need one mutation and can then go on with cloning. And it's very interesting because we Benna grows here like 19 different varieties, and we've got some, we will talk about that later, that we use as plants for a certain pollination. We want to crossbreed certain species to get our aim, our goal. Actually, Arthur and me have kind of different ideas how a perfect potato looks like. I want to have it like a cube, so that you just have to cut 6 times to get to get it peeled. But that will definitely not work. We have the same idea about the color. We want to have a potato that has a very nice color and looks somewhat special. And we both want a potato that is perfectly growing in this kind of sacks. So we are going to breed the Kreuzberger Sack. That's going to be the name of the potato. And I guess with the squared ones I will not be successful. But we will definitely be successful. Also wants to have one with a really interesting shape. We will definitely have lots of discussions in autumn, and we are both looking forward to harvest them for the first time, because it's interesting, and it's kind of, we absolutely have no idea how the potatoes are going to look like that we grow now.
Maybe
next year we are going to to define what is, or this year we're going to define what is father and mother plant. For that, it is also relatively easy. We use the flowers before they open. Open them mechanically, take out the anthers, the male part of the flower, and put some fabric around it so that no pollen from any plant can reach the female part of the flower. And then we have to wait for a couple of days until it gets ripe. And then we take the pollen from the plant we want to have, we choose as a father plant, and use a brush, and then just apply them, or just put them on the female plant, and they will grow like a potato fruit. It's about that big, pretty poisonous, and take one fruit has lots and lots of seeds, 50 to 100 to 150 seeds is definitely, and we are going to torture our mother and father plants. Normally the potato would...
This is the fruit.
Normally the potato would build tubers, but we prevent our potatoes from building tubers by putting them on a stone. We put the potatoes on a stone and dig them into, cover them with soil like that high. And as soon as the roots that go over the stones are big enough to survive, if they are digged out and are just going over the stone, we take the soil away, and then the plant can definitely not build tubers, because the tubers are not growing from the roots, but they are stem metamorphoses.
What is a tuber? The potato itself.
It does not grow from the roots, but only from the stem. And if we... if the stem does not have any contact to soil at all, it cannot build tubers. And therefore the plant starts to panic and build lots of flowers, grow higher, and tries to reproduce itself only from fruits. And that's good for us, because then we get nice big fruits and can choose the best ones, take only the seeds that really look like they are going to germinate. And and we can, as I told earlier, define what is mother plant and what is father plant.
Yeah. So, during the research for this breeding project, I came over a publication titled "The Amateur Potato Breeder's Handbook," and I have some examples here. And it's also hanging down. We have like an information pole down there. We can make a little walk later on and take a look at everything. But this is on the net, and it can be downloaded on the net, so it's accessible. It's written by a Canadian plant scientist named Raoul Robinson. And it made me very curious, this book. And it also became very important for how I structured the narrative in Engebeka. I don't know if any one of you have been to Engebeka and seen the exhibition, but I've made a narrative structure on A4 sheets on the wall there. So, in this handbook... Robinson argues for a method of breeding based on recurrent mass selection, it's called. And this method is primarily focused on the disease resistance in the plant. So not if it is squared or in nice shapes, but on the disease resistance. And this method aims for boosting the plant's general immune system. Rather than involving gene transfer techniques to breed specific disease-resistant or disease-resistant genes into the plant. So these are two different models or two different approaches to breeding. You can breed for horizontal resistance or for vertical resistance. And this can be compared, for example, when you get a vaccination towards the bird flu, for example, that can be compared to a vertical resistance, that you get the vaccination for a very specific kind of flu, but if then the virus mutates, this vaccination is not helping any longer. So it's a very specific gene that is targeted, and if this gene is bred into the plant, then it is completely resistant, but it's not a very durable resistance after so when the disease changes, which it does naturally, this is not working any longer. And this recurrent mass selection, where you breed for the horizontal resistance, you aim for boosting the immune system in general of the plant. So, for example, it could be that you get the flu, you get the bird flu, and you get ill, but you have a good immune system in general. You're quite healthy. So it means that you get ill, but you don't die. And maybe you're lucky and you don't get ill at all. So it's two different approaches to diseases and also to resistance. And you could also say that the recurrent mass selection is more or less the method of seed saving that has been used historically among farmers to improve the crops, where you keep the best seeds for next year, and in this way you improve your crop over time, and you also adapt it to the microclimate where it grows. So if we in the garden now continues to grow year after year, and we keep every year the best tubers, we will slowly get a crop that is functioning to grow in this microclimate, but is maybe not functioning in Italy, for example. Ah, thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. Yeah, it depends, I would say. I think it really, maybe you should have like a rooftop variety and under the tree shadow variety. I think that could be, yeah, I would say that could be a better difference than Neukölln and Horsberg and so on. Yeah. And the pedigree breeding, which is this gene transfer technique breeding, this is developed after the laws of inheritance were understood at the end of the 19th century, when Mendel discovered the laws of inheritance. And I'm sure in school you all learned that you have these banana flies and they cross, or you have blue eyes or brown eyes and all this. So when this was understood, which was like a really was a very radical understanding, or like a radical experience that is actually possible to manipulate features of plants and animals and living material, this method got all the focus, or the main focus, and has been since then the main method for breeding plants, at least in Western Europe or in the Western world. So the reason why Robinson suggests this recurrent mass selection, is especially for amateur breeders in his book, is that it's more labor intense, and it also takes longer time. It can take, I mean, it, we can have a nice variety already this year. These are seedlings from last year, but it could also take 7 years to get a good variety. So
it's like playing lotto. So it's just you don't. It's not a
system.
Yeah, it's not like a. You're not aiming for your special goal. You're just trying it out.
Yeah. So this is one reason why it's not used by commercial breeders. But the thing with recurrent mass selection is that you get varieties that won't need as much pesticides as the varieties grown from the pedigree breeding. So it could be argued that most commercial breeders are owned by chemical companies, Monsanto, DuPont, etc., which are like the big corporations for seeds, also have their own breeding laboratories. And for them, maybe it hasn't been so important to breed for resistance, because you can also develop a package where you target for some resistance, and then you have a package with the different pesticides towards, as a security thing. This is how most farmers grow today, that you don't buy only the seeds, you also buy a whole package of specific pesticide and fertilizer. And it's also like a contract, so you have to use all these different chemicals in order to get insurance if you have a failure, for example, with your crop.
Actually, it's an attempt of the big breeders to get a monopoly on plants, because if they have a genetically engineered product, they can have a patent on it. And normally, if you grow a seed, you can just get a seed a breed protection that is not a patent. And they just try to, get a monopole.
Yeah. So, for example, it's interesting that one of the varieties we grow here is called Sarpomyra. It was bred for the Soviet bloc. It was bred in Hungary. And this was bred with this method of horizontal, to breed for horizontal resistance. Because in the Soviet time, the costs of pesticides and fertilizers, chemical fertilizers, was too high, and one had to develop varieties that can have a strong resistance in themselves. So it is possible to do it. It's more a question about how you distribute different interests and risk. And another interesting thing we found out during the research is that in the Julius Kuhn Institute, close to Rostock here in Germany, there is actually at the moment a research project on this recurrent mass selection breeding method that is initiated by actually the German Agricultural Ministry, because they are interested in finding out and learning more about this method. And we have some varieties growing here now that we have got from this research project that are supposed to have a stronger resistance in themselves. And I think this is the only place in Europe where anyone is really growing with this method now. So anyway, so what you also said is that we will do the breeding here informed by both methods, you could say, because we also have an interest in specific features, not only to breed for resistance. But anyway, we will expose the plants for different diseases and illnesses, and those who die off, and we just keep those who make it and who survive or look nice or have the feature we like. So anyway, and this year we start, and we will see how many years we continue. But it's for sure a long-term project. And I have... This is another book by Raoul Robison. It's called Return to Resistance. So if anyone is interested to learn more about this, this can be quite interesting to look into.